Hello, I'm Russ Camidge, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today is Adam Lee, and I'm really excited because he's going to act as our guide into a very different way of assessing whether new cancer treatments are good or bad. Adam, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Oh, well, thank you, Ross, for having me on the podcast this time. My name, Adam Lee. How would I describe myself? I think first and foremost, I'd probably call myself a regular guy in his mid to late 30s. A family person. I have a niece and a nephew, so I'm quite often called the fun uncle or funcle. But from a professional standpoint, you know, I view myself as a kind of a highly experienced global health economist. And as you say, in that aspect, that's where, you know, our kind of lives have interlocked and crossroads.
Well, let's start at the beginning. So obviously we're going to lead up into health economics, but where did young Adam grow up?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. So
it's a little complex, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. A little complex. Yeah. So if you can tell from my accent, you'll understand I'm English. And so, yeah, I would say I consider myself as English and grown up predominantly in England. Maybe I would consider a little bit by accidental birth. I was actually born in the US, mostly driven because my dad, before I was born, was sort of headhunted and brought over to the US in his field of operations, which is medical physics. And my mum and dad had me over in the US.
So Pittsburgh, where did you get born?
It was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that was where I was born. But quite quickly, my mum and dad separated, and me, my mum, and my older brother moved back to the UK, and that's kind of where I've spent my life growing up. My dad stayed in the US, so I'm very regularly back and forth between the US over the years, and Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Florida, plus multiple other places, you name it. So yeah, in England, it's Cambridgeshire where I grew up actually, predominantly in kind of a few small villages in that area.
And then how much older is your brother?
My brother's 5 years older than me. Yeah, no, it's a good age gap. When you're younger, it probably feels quite big. As you get older, it definitely feels a lot smaller.
Yeah, that's just the way it goes. And then your mum, so you're pretty young when your parents separated, right?
Oh yeah, I don't really ever remember, you know, having my dad like in the house or anything. I think one or two, you know, I was very young when the separation happened and we moved back to England. And so yeah, my kind of earliest memories were kind of from being in England, back in England again already.
And then your mum, I think you told me, had a job as a medical secretary?
Yeah, my mum, I mean, PA, secretary, senior secretary. So she's currently in a consultancy based in Cambridge at the moment with kind of medical technology and innovations. But she's worked within hospitals and the medical sphere as well. So I think from my perspective, my family perspective, my dad, myself, my brother, my mum, we've all kind of been in and around the medical area and the science area actually from a young age. So it's been quite natural in that environment, I would say, for myself.
Yeah, I think you described your brother, and I do hope he gets to listen to this and punch you, as a failed vet.
Well, I mean, I think he wanted to be a vet, you know. I think at the same time, when maybe going to university and considering at that time, it was a highly popular course for a lot of people to go into. So animals are a huge importance for my brother. I think they're his life and blood. So he went more into the animal sciences route and not a pure vet. But yeah, that's what he ultimately kind of wanted to be, I think, when he was younger. But yeah, still animals are his life and blood, I would say. They're his heir.
Okay, so you're growing up, you know, your mum's a medical secretary, your dad is a radiation physicist and, you know, works in these areas. And your brother is an animal scientist. So when do you get an idea? Because, you go, not everybody knows the British educational system, which is you start to sort of specialize as a kind of artist or scientist, like super early, like 15 or 16. So, I mean, it sounds like you were going to drift into the sciences. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I guess I had a couple of years living over in America to finish off kind of the high school diploma. It wasn't really the best. I guess looking back now, it probably wasn't the optimal time for me to have that opportunity to live with my dad, because I was halfway through, as you say, in the educational system in England, and maybe contrasting to the US, what kind of is high school in the US, we have secondary school. And then between the ages of sort of 14 to 16, you do exams called GCSEs. And then they kind of are your first stepping stone to kind of, you finish those at 16. And in the past, you had the opportunity, do you leave school and go into maybe trades, building, plumber, etc.? Or do you go on and do A-levels, which get you into university, which is kind of what helps you get into university? I was halfway through the GCSE, so I did my first year. And then the opportunity came to live with my dad for 3 years, and I did that. And so when I came back from America, I was kind of done the high school, but I missed the GCSEs, and I hadn't done A-levels because I was already 18. And so I had to do an extra year of A-levels, actually. And that was 1 year in Chesterfield. And I did 3 A-levels all in 1 year, which is remarkable when you consider that.
It's pretty impressive. Yeah.
Pretty impressive. You know, and I think for me, numbers have always been pretty good. I'm quite okay with numbers. I like the science, but maybe not the pure science. I don't think I wanted to go into biology or medical biology or physics like my dad did. That's pretty intense. So it really stood out from quite a before that, actually, when I was thinking about different opportunities, you know, 14, 15 and on. Economics is kind of one where I thought that's quite nice. It's quite broad. It gives it quite a lot of opportunity. And pretty much every industry, every company, every job around the world has some form of economics associated with it. And so I thought, well, that will be a kind of a degree I could do at university that gives me quite a bit of openness, but also interestingness. And it keeps within the numbers and the science, or the weak science is what they kind of label it. But yeah, that's kind of where I went when I went to university. That's what I decided to do. And even in the university system in the UK, it's a slightly contrasting to the US. I think most universities or colleges in the US, you kind of do a major and a minor, and you do some general education, and then you kind of focus the major part towards the end of it. In England, it's kind of very intense 3-year period, fully focused on your subject, and that is it. You don't keep that general education. So you kind of walk out as degree in economics and...
Yeah, it's like an expert. Or at least the beginnings of an expert, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, not PhD level, let's say. And so that's kind of where I went. And then that's what I did as my undergraduate. And then the consideration of what do you do once you finish the undergraduate kind of started.
So you did the 3 years in Kingston University, which is actually not a million miles away from where I grew up. Yeah. And then... You know, like you say, economics, you know, could go into any area. So you have a cool story, I think, how you figured out the health economics was the next step.
Yeah. So doing economics, I kind of realized during the course that I really found the kind of the theory and the principles of economics interesting, but maybe the purest of economics is a bit too intense for me. And so many people may have heard of things like Freakonomics and other kind of podcasts and books that were written at a similar time. And I think what was fascinating about them was they had this kind of, how do you apply the kind of the thoughts of economics or the theories behind economics, but to these kind of really unusual questions? How do you utilize economics beyond the kind of basic interest rates and saving rates and inflation rates? And so when I was at university, I did a couple of courses in economics of crime and sports economics. And yeah, I was kind of looking around thinking, okay, there's business and economic forecasting. I like the modeling side of things with economics. How do I predict different aspects? And then I came across this course called Health Economics at another university, City University in London. I went for an open evening. And just reading the course, I think it really struck out to me. It has the kind of the modeling applications, it has the utilization of economics, but it's also addressing these other questions. And as time back to my family growing up, you know, my dad, medical physics, I'd been around you know, seeing him in centers setting up these massive machines for radiation therapy and providing it to patients and understanding the kind of the aspects of needing to treat these patients, I thought, well, health economics sounds like it's a pretty standard. It's a pretty cool kind of career to go into. It felt quite safe. It felt like there's always going to be an opportunity there. It feels like we're going to need to be able to treat patients and that aspect. And so, yeah, that was kind of main reason I think I ended up there is kind of taking the economic theories and applying it to those kind of unusual based questions is a kind of a big driver for myself.
When you went through the health economics, I think it was a MSc, and I think your master's thesis was already on cancer. Was it prostate cancer or something?
It was, yeah. So I, it was a kind of 1 and a bit years in total in length for myself. So I did the kind of full focus, went straight from undergraduate into my master's. And I think back now, could I go back and do a master's today or even a PhD? I think, oh, I don't know if I'm in the world of being able to go back to studying.
I was going, why would you? Why would you? These things are stepping stones.
But when I did that, yeah, you have to do like a dissertation or a thesis. And mine was sort of essentially the cost effectiveness of helical tomotherapy compared with IMRT in the treatment.
These are all radiation terms.
Yeah, they're radiation therapy. So partly because of the experience of my dad and having some insights there, but mostly because prostate cancer actually is quite a fascinating disease in the sense that actually it probably lends itself to being utilized within the radiation therapy services more than most cancers, just in the sense that it can be a really slow and indolent growing cancer. And so surgery can be quite an impact on a patient's life for prostate cancer. So where do you start? What's the best option here? We have a lot of treatments now. We have some good treatment options for it. I think there's always needed new treatment options. There's always more treatments needed. But kind of helical tomotherapy in its concept is, if you imagine taking like a CT scanner, where it can kind of go 360 around the patient, and you apply the actual the unit that can fire the radiation therapy out to the patient, but it has like little beams to kind of match the cancer and the tumor size and shape. Yeah. It kind of does it as a consistent 360, whereas the IMRT can only go to certain degree ranges. And so the question was just, okay, is it more cost effective to use this newer technology, which might cost a little bit more money, but it may give some better application of the treatment? But that's, yeah, mostly stemmed from a kind of knowing a little bit about that insight and interesting. It's slightly different to the others, but yeah, that's kind of what I did for my thesis. It was quite interesting.
And then your first job was AstraZeneca, is that right?
My first job after I finished my master's, I ended up at one of the larger pharma companies, AstraZeneca at the time. And it was more of a UK kind of, I would say broadly speaking in pharma, there's tend to be layers on how you would focus. You know, you have a kind of country level, which is teams that are more focused on supporting all of the needs in that country specifically. You kind of then have maybe a regional or a global based part to the to companies which kind of manage slightly higher up, but think about the more global perspective. And so my first role was within AstraZeneca in the UK level, supporting a number of disease areas, but a big focus in oncology. You'll notice oncology stems, and it comes up quite a few times when we talk through. Maybe part of the history with oncology and why it's fascinating or why it's an area for me. Not only do I think it's an interesting disease area and really fascinating in terms of how we need to treat it. And obviously it's one of those, there's a lot of cancers that we still haven't yet hit the pinnacle of being able to say cure. As much as we'd like to believe that. And so there's always need for new treatments. Family-wise, most families now, I would say, have some impact of cancer at some level. It doesn't seem to get smaller. But my dad's side of the family, actually, my granddad had several siblings, I think 5 siblings in the end. And all of those had actually suffered with cancer and ultimately passed away with cancer to date. And my granddad's 94, 95, maybe 96. He still hasn't yet and I touch wood that he doesn't ever get it, had cancer as a diagnosis. So clearly there's some relationship there. There's probably some genetic aspect to it, but the timings of when they were diagnosed was back in the days when gene tests, etc., weren't routinely done, and we don't really, you know all the gene aspects of them. But yeah, from a family perspective, once you've kind of had that so impactful in your family, it also drives you to want to kind of understand it better and be there to support and kind of say, right, we don't want this to affect others the same way.
So let's talk a little bit about what a health economist does. And over the time, you've moved company and you've increased in your, you know, prolific thing. Your current job and title is what?
Director of Health Economics and Outcomes Research in the global team for oncology within another larger pharma organization, Bristol Myers Squibb. Although, you know, that's what it is currently.
Yeah. So what does a health economist in pharma do?
Yeah. I mean, health economics and outcomes research, you kind of often see those words together when we look at jobs within the pharma industry or kind of surrounding. In my mind, the way I kind of pitch it, Ross, is sort of maybe three or four big pillars that can chunk up some of the bigger items that we can do. But maybe the fascination and why I enjoy it so much actually is it lends itself across a vast spectrum of different approaches. So one thing is data generation. You know, we're quite often considered one of the functions that can lead data generation activities. When I say data generation, we might consider that to look like real-world evidence data. So we know trials take place. Maybe a lot of your listeners know this. You do kind of big pivotal phase three trials or phase two trials. We often, in oncology, range in numbers of participants. You can range from smaller numbers if it's a really rare oncology disease, maybe in the tens or hundreds, up to maybe closer to 1,000 if it's on a bigger disease, let's say. And the trials are great and they're fantastic and they help prove that benefit and safety risk, and that helps with regulatory discussions on the initial aspect. But once you've got that medicine available and it's being used in the community or regular clinical practice, I think there's even more growing considerations today than I've ever seen in the past, where it's saying, hold on, we want to continue to look at how does that medicine help actually in the real practice, in that real clinical practice where there isn't a trial setting. So we quite often do a lot of real world evidence studies, and they can be prospective, they can be retrospective, and that helps us appreciate, you know, the continued evolution of safety and understanding what that looks like. It also continues to help us appreciate efficacy, and it may help in particular circumstances where we might think about the population, right? So a trial might have certain patients that can get in the trial for various reasons. There may also be patients that ultimately don't always get in the trials for other reasons, and so it kind of helps us understand exactly those. And that, to me, and what I've seen is that these can be utilized at several areas of the life cycle of products, right? They can be used for regulatory considerations. So we see, for example, in the US, you know, sometimes we have these really impressive products that come forwards and they've got some really impressive early trial data, but that's not the end of it. And they might get kind of an earlier license or an earlier application, and FDA, EMA, whoever is the regulator, really might say, we like what you're showing us today and we think everything's looking very good. We believe that this is such an unmet need area that you need to have access today so that patients aren't going to be missing the opportunity to get treated. But at the same time, we're going to come back and look at this in a year, 2-3 years time and confirm that everything you've told us aligns up. So real world evidence can play a really big role in supporting those type of discussions. And data generation is sort of clinical trial basis. We're involved in clinical trials. So another aspect you may hear of patient reported outcomes is the kind of key term we might refer to, or clinical outcomes assessments. And what they really are talking about is we want to understand how do patients feel, and how does the treatment help patients, not just on a scan, on a physical ability to see what's happening with the disease, let's say, but actually on an emotional and mobility perspective? And so do patients, does the quality of life look better or worse for patients or compared to different treatments? And so we often utilize these patient report outcome tools, their questions. You can rank on a scale, you know, were you able to get out of bed today and such and such. And so we, you know, the HUR team tends to take a kind of leadership space with that type of outcome assessment. Why? One, because it kind of sits within our area and we've kind of designed these tools and worked with the clinical community on them. But secondly, and another pillar of where HUR kind of, and it probably is more known for this aspect, is once you have a medicine and the trial's been done and you maybe have got regulatory approval around the world, and it's becoming increasingly more common, is that there are some reimbursement bodies, the HTA bodies, as we might call them, so health technology assessments or appraisal bodies, where they say to us, okay, that's great, you've got this medicine, but somebody needs to pay for this medicine, and we need to assess, is the medicine and the cost and the outcomes that you're giving us, is that helping our clinical community, and is it worth the money? And, you know, one of the most famous or most widely known is NICE, National Institute of Care and Health Excellence in the UK, which really looks at saying, okay, you got this medicine, come to us, submit this HTA dossier, we'll review it. And in NICE, they're typically uses a kind of cost-effective threshold. So these cost-effectiveness comes into the discussion, you know, £20,000 to £30,000 per quali. Quali is the quality adjusted life year. And so to do that, we need to model them, and to model it, we need to put in there the kind of patient reported outcome assessment into the model with the costs associated with the treatments. But we also need to understand, okay, when you give that treatment, we take the clinical outcomes from the trials and the real world data. We need to translate to what that looks like over what we would consider a lifetime horizon, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, however long is expected for the average person in that setting to live for. And that's where I think the kind of another pillar comes in. It's how we can work with the clinical data and all of the data surrounding that product. And that's kind of analyzing it, providing that clinical context, running different analyses to kind of help. And so we quite often have the case when you go to a HTA submission, you quite often have the case when you're launching a medicine, you're not the only medicine in the setting. There's quite often other medicines. Some are older, some are more newer. And not always do trials get run against every comparator. Yeah. You know, we quite often have treatment A versus treatment B, but there may be treatment C and D that we've never put in that trial. How do we compare to those? And so we might run things such as indirect treatment comparison analyses, and that kind of helps us say, in the absence of a formal trial, we can take the known clinical data from one trial, one from another trial, and be able to link them and connect them and run the appropriate statistical models and methods to kind of give us an answer of which treatment would look better, worse, same. And then we can apply that in the models with our HTAs and also those ITCs, for example, they can be used beyond just HTAs.
What's an ITC?
Indirect treatment comparison, sorry. So it's indirect treatment comparison.
A sort of simulated trial.
Yeah, it uses, you know, statistical methods, and there's various methods out there, right? So we have Boucher ITCs, which, you know, if you were to say A is better than B and B is better than C, then we know that A has to be better than C.
Yeah.
Through the linkage. But we don't always get that answer. Sometimes you get A is better than B. B is worse than C, then how does C and A compare? And so in more recent times, we've evolved those methods to enable things like matched adjusted indirect treatment comparisons, which enable us to weight and kind of make sure that the trial A and trial B are being matched appropriately, so you kind of get in the same population rather very different populations. And that's a challenge we face in every aspect. So it's kind of, it's that data generation where we're kind of helping drive new and continued data to support understanding the clinical aspect and the benefits of that treatment in that population. It's that other aspect of utilizing that data and our techniques within HUR to support answering that question and support reimbursement around the world. And what reimbursement means, and forgive me if I'm being a little bit ignorant or naive here, but in a country such as the US, where there's a very heavy privatized system, patients can pay quite a lot for private insurance and get quite a good access remit. Now, it's not always cheap to a lot of medicines. In a lot of countries outside the US, I would say Europe particularly, where you have kind of more national health services. So in the UK, if I turn up to the hospital and I've got a disease and I need a treatment, that treatment is covered for me. I'm not paying for that medicine. Where you have that sort of system, the challenge is you need to be able to say we're providing access to what we consider the best effective medicines or the best available medicines for the patients, but also a value that is considered appropriate for what we've got as a budget and what we can pay. So that's kind of the main aim of HTA, is sort of trying to say we've got this new medicine and the cost of it or the providing patients access to this medicine is worth the other side of that factor. So what you have to pay and how you need to implement it. And then it's tied all within that is our kind of HUR methods, where we're continuing to evolve and how to look at clinical data better and how to context it better and how to make more sense of it from that communication perspective.
Let me pull some of that apart.
Go for it.
Yeah. So what I hadn't realized is, yeah, I kept calling you a health economist, but it's HEOR, health economics and outcomes research. And a big chunk of it is that outcomes research, that real world data. You know, you've got your clinical trial in these cherry-picked patients, but how does it do after the drug is licensed? So where do you get the information from the real world to analyze?
That varies, Ross. It kind of depends on several factors. You know, it depends on what you're looking to answer. What's the question you're trying to answer, right? I think that's always what it stems from. What is that data gap, that knowledge gap that you're looking for? And what I love about the job is, as I say, you know, in the way it challenges the brain on what we have to do, we're trying to solve these complex questions and using, I'd say, creative methodology, but it's robust methodology, but in creative thinking. But it's also that interaction, right? So we might think pharma, from the kind of medicines or who are developing the medicines, may think we know a data gap. We might think this is the question that needs to be answered, but that might be our data gap. The clinicians, yourself, others may say, actually, what we really want to know is how does it perform when a patient has brain mets, for example, something like that. And so what's relevant for you may also be relevant for the other side, but it may also be different to our understanding. So we need to work in harmony to understand that, so that we're saying, okay, well, we're trying to answer is the question that you need answered as well as others. So that working with you may lead us to understand what is the best approach to kind of answering that question, right? Is the best approach retrospective data? Because there's a lot of sources of data where there's databases. In the US, there's a big one, Flatiron. There's others that are out there where, you know, it is collected certain information. It can kind of give us broader understandings. We know how many patients have a particular disease. We know kind of what the average cost might be, because you can quantify how many treatments they've received, and you can look at how long a treatment may have been given for, etc. And it may capture things like progression-free or treatment length or survival length, and you might be able to understand that even retrospectively. But in other ones, we might need to do that more prospectively. And if it's prospectively, that's very different, because then you need to work with a center or a database source or somebody that has the ability to enroll or kind of register that information, collect it firsthand. So that one might be that we need to work more closely with a clinical center or a center that kind of hosts multiple centers and work with the kind of clinical community more directly. They're kind of your two main obvious options, but that's quite often where real world evidence is talked about in the main front, I would say. And that's, I won't give all exhaustive lists, but that's kind of a perspective of kind of how we might collect that data.
Okay, so I have a question here. So one of the truisms of oncology is the perceived efficacy of a treatment tends to go down as you go from the more restricted clinical trials, phase one studies to phase two studies to phase three. And again, as you extend out from super specialized academic centers that can do all the supportive care out to the sort of more community sites. So do you ever get the commercial people in your company going, Adam, we really don't want you to look here? I mean, what happens if you go, well, this totally sucks in the community?
I mean, it's a good question. And I'm talking from my experience and my personal views, not from a company or anybody else's perspective here, Roz. I think ultimately, you know, why we tend to see some differences between trials maybe and compared to the real world setting is that, you know, the trials may not always be able to take in certain groups of patients or all the groups of patients. And when we get into the real world setting, we quite often know that we might not be talking, you know, for example, if you're working on a medicine in oncology, the trial setting and the application and the license may say second line or second line plus. It may be, okay, yeah. You know, once they've progressed after they've received a previous treatment. Now, that can vary in the circumstance of whether a clinician decides to use it, because it may be that the patient isn't truly second line in the real world setting. It may be more akin to a third line patient. And as patients tend to progress, unfortunately, the efficacy will diminish quite often. But that doesn't mean that the treatment's not working effectively. It may just be the numbers may change slightly between the trials. So I think that's the other aspect is context, right? So when you look at the real world, you need to be able to explain what does that real world population actually tell you? Who are you looking at and what's the result? And how does that, and what is the interpretation of that from a truer kind of clinical perspective? And I think that's where real world as clinician involvement is really critical, because if a number looks lower, you might go, well, that's worse. That's not great. But then the clinician might tell him, I say, but the patient, the group of patients we're treating here are really poorly patients.
Yeah.
So what you're getting here is phenomenal. It's really good. You know, for us, I mean, I don't want to use outlandish wording, but, you know, the clinicians might say, oh, I'm really impressed with this result, even if it looks lower than what you'd hope for. So commercial-wise, data generation, and again, this is me, my experience and what I've seen in companies, is I think the way it tends to be split is certain groups and functions sit in certain areas of the business and they have certain rules about them. So data generation activities, things like clinical trials, real-world evidence, they sit more with teams that are able to do that and are not promotional or focus. So a health economist is never considered promotional in pharma traditionally, which means that if a commercial person is promotional, the actions of promotion is very separate to the actions of a non-promotional, because science and the evidence should be driving forward your strategy rather than purely sales-based, let's say. So my experience has always been that there may be strategies, there may be aspects about launching a medicine, where we're at in the launch, you know, what population are we, if your trial population is quite broad. I've worked in lung cancer, breast cancer, et cetera. And sometimes you have multiple groups of patients in there, you know, which patient do you give it to?
Yeah.
For example, in PD-L, in the IO therapy space, you have PD-L1 levels, you know, do you PD-L1 negative? Do you look at the normal? Do you look at the high expressors, for example? There may be reasons why certain patients slightly benefit a little bit higher and you may want to focus more towards that group. But on the flip side, real world evidence is considered more of a non-promotional and a data generation activity. So a promotional team, commercial, let's say, in my experience, have never been able to derive the strategy for real world evidence. Even if you share with them the perspectives, they say, okay, That's that. They're not there to kind of tell us not to do it. That's not what's been allowed in my experience.
Yeah, and I think if I reflect on my experiences with investigator-initiated trials, so when an academic writes a study, submits it to a pharma company for support, you're right. One of the things they really like is when I'm looking at areas which are expanding an indication, and it may fail because, you know, they're sicker patients or whatever. But one of my other experiences, what they don't like is me looking at their licensed population and the stuff from the trial and then trying to subdivide it. But you're right, that's not outcomes research. That's a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, and not to get caught in the weeds, but it's kind of one of those things that, you know, if you've got a very heavy, robust phase three trial, then the reasons you do those trials and the reasons that you kind of have a big population, for example, is that you weed out those extreme variables and you kind of understand the true aspect of what's going on, right? But if a real world study has 50 patients in total, and you've had a trial with 500 patients in total, then you're more than likely to pick up more of the extremes in the real world. So again, it's about understanding that population, really putting that clinical context. Can we explain differences? Can we explain similarities? Can we understand why it may not be completely the same? And I wouldn't say, I mean, you know, I've been involved in a number of real world studies. There's definitely times when it comes out and you think, oh, that's, unfortunately, it doesn't look to be completely the same as the trial, but then doing a bit of research and digging around of it, you can understand that actually, if you have a patient that's equal performance status 3 or 2 compared to a trial, which doesn't normally always include such performance status, it can have some reasons why, and it can be explained. You know, I think the reality is there are so many reasons why different aspects happen. And in oncology, as you know, Ross, what is the variable you're looking at, right? If it's survival, overall survival has remained a gold standard outcome. Why? Because it's clear. It's either you're alive or you're dead. It's there's no argumentation about it.
Yeah.
In oncology, another variable that is really important, that can be really important for patients, but it doesn't always translate or is not always understood exactly, in my opinion, is progression-free survival, right? You know, progression-free survival is, we're holding the disease back from progressing or getting worse, but they're still alive. And at some point, you know, especially in the later stage oncologies, they're going to progress. But how are you assigning what that progression is? Is it based on the judgment of the clinician, or is it based on the judgment of a scan? Is it based on, again, there can be differences of how you look at that progression and what the factor is. And did a patient stop treatment because the patient couldn't tolerate the treatment, but is still getting a response? Or did the patient stop the treatment because the treatment stopped working? And sometimes that's the other aspect we have to be careful. So I think all of those factors tie into why it's a really fascinating area and why real-world evidence plays a really supportive role and it's an important area, but it's still not perfect. There's still areas where we can continue to improve, right? And that only evolves and improves, I think, with that relationship and that kind of continued dialogue between the clinical community setting, clinicians like yourself, and those that are running those studies to understand where the pitfalls are and how do we interpret that data appropriately, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was a drug that was licensed fairly recently in lung cancer, and its progression-free survival, the time it took for the cancer to progress, appeared better than other stuff in the field. The study was mostly done in China, and they didn't do very frequent scans, and they didn't scan the brain. And, you know, it's easy to make someone's progression-free survival look better by not looking as often.
And again, you know, I think there's different ways to look at that. And there's, you know, without knowing the study in depth, I would say that we talk about trials, and when we talk about regulatory approvals, we typically look at global-based trials, right? That they involve recruitment of patients from multiple countries that represent a broad spectrum of the world rather than one country alone. And if you do one country alone, is it clinical practice? Did the clinical practice differ? Other patients, you know, we've seen in oncology, particularly if we think about mutations, right? We've seen where Asian patients might have a very high mutation rate compared to Western cultures. We've seen where there may not be that difference. And so there's all sorts of variables that run into that. There's all sorts of reasons why trials are run the way trials are run. The team that designed the trial designed it for various reasons. Each have pros, each have cons. They're not small costs generally when you run a trial.
Yeah.
They're huge amounts. You know, if we take on the economics of it, and maybe my figures aren't going to be 100% perfect here, but I think in the main, broadly, when it's been spoken about in the past, you're looking on average before a product even launches and gets into any kind of commercial utilization, you're spending $1 billion to $2 billion before you've made a single cent back on that medicine. And there's a huge number of fails, right? When we run trials, and every trial that gets run, you learn a lot about, right? You learn the science of whether it's positive, negative, why did it fail? Why did it positive? What patients? If it wasn't a positive because the population was very large, is it going to be positive in a smaller population? So there's various aspects to it all, right? And that's not all within the HEOR sphere, but I think real world evidence is just one of those components that can, because it's the real world, you need that regulatory, because you need it post access for the patients. It's that kind of continued effort to continue driving that scientific evidence and understanding and knowledge base.
Yeah, I remember when I got a first glimpse of the cost of pharma-sponsored clinical trials. And so my figures are probably about a decade old, but this particular phase three registrational study was $70 million. And for me, the thing that blew me away is the government-run cooperative groups, which also run clinical trials, their entire budget for like all disease types is like $20 million. And it's like, okay, it's not a competition, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's a great aspect nowadays. I think overall there's a lot of collaboration, right? We have to work together to deliver these, because if you don't work together, you're not going to deliver a new medicine. And
yeah.
And you know, it's very easy to look on one pure aspect on its own right, the price of a medicine, for example, or something like that, and take challenge with it. But overall, we're all in the same ask. We all want the same thing, right? We want the very best medicines as possible to get to patients and have access to them. And I think the outlay from a pharma side is very significant. When you look at R&D budgets, just at the larger pharmas, they're very large, multi-billions a year. I won't go into any specific names, but they're quite often a large chunk of their overall revenues. And they're paying that without having any patient actually actively being used on that treatment. It's all investigating the new molecules. And each one that fails is a lost opportunity potentially for the patients. Although if it fails, it's not good. We don't want to get failed medicines to patients either. But it's an aspect you have to burden that cost and then take on and say, okay, we've kind of lost the opportunity here. This is never going to get there. It narrows one molecule out, whichever case it is. And there's notoriously difficult diseases, right? There's some diseases that almost have never seen a really good treatment available for it or even got there. We're still really trying. I think even in like Alzheimer's or...
Yeah, I was thinking neurological conditions, like motor neuron disease and things like that.
Phenomenally difficult, you know. And there's not that they're not researching it. There's a lot of research that gets done into those areas, right? So I think that the kind of HEOR sphere, we can be involved from, you know, when I'm my global health economics hat and I'm leading the kind of a product or an indication, I'm in there from sort of almost day one. I'm in there from a very early stage, ensuring that we're kind of designing that phase three or the pivotal trial right with the PROs, all the way through to launch, and then post-launch supporting kind of continued access and continued understanding of that data in the real world. So it's not an end thing. It's 10 years plus beyond an indication.
Let's dip a little bit into the health economics. Yeah. And I think one of the things to establish early is you explained to me that you're nothing to do with pricing. Okay, that's a separate group of people.
Often, yeah.
But the pricing people, presumably, they don't just, you know, ignore the efficacy. There must be some assessment of saying like, okay, this is an amazing drug and therefore we should price it this, and this is a so-so drug. And, you know, so are they doing that all by themselves, or do they just come and whisper in your ear?
It's a good question. I mean, I'll be, yeah, be very, very clear here. And again, this is my perspective and where I sit and what I've seen. You know, I don't sit within a pure pricing team, and pricing isn't in my remit to control. Can health economics, outcomes research, can the health economists help pricing considerations? Absolutely, we can. In some areas, pricing and HEOR are more interlinked, where we have more clear hurdles or burdens, or HTA groups such as NICE, for example, you know, where it's very clear-cut cost effectiveness is a very significant part to play in what might ultimately end up becoming an appraisal, approval or not approval, then we have to factor in what price might look like there. But again, my experience has never been that I'm in charge of that aspect from a HE perspective. And, you know, obviously there needs approvals at certain levels, right? Like somebody has to say yes or no to a price. If you request a price, it's different. There's various factors that come into to pricing, if I'm honest with you, Ross. You know, we have some countries refer to other pricing. We talk about reference pricing. You know, there's other products that you can look at and see what they've been approved. There's confidentiality in pricing, so it's sometimes hard to gauge what others are. So there's all sorts of factors that go into that. I'd be careful to sort of not say too much more because pricing isn't my expert specific area. I'm not in the pricing team.
Sure.
And it's obviously a hot topic. We all know that, you know, pricing is a hot topic. I think there's various factors that can help you appreciate what might look like on a price, but each country has a very different setup, very different specifications. You know, some countries are a bit more public and have very specific rules in it, and they kind of, you have very clear barriers, and that's just that. This is the price of the product, and that's what it's going to be, and that's how they do it, and they publicize it. In other countries, it's a little bit more flexible, let's say. And so working through that, you know, there's various factors.
How much do countries focus just on the bang for the buck? So, you know, it costs this much and the efficacy is this, and maybe you take into account the side effects from quality adjusted life years versus the total impact on that country's budget. Because even if it looks really bad as one person, that's very different from if there's, you know, half the population involved.
I think we've seen examples of that in the past. I'm not going to name names, but for example, where a product has come, it's been highly efficacious, like really fantastic and phenomenal results. And ultimately, you'd want to give it to every patient. But by doing that, your budget goes in day one. And so cost effectiveness talks more about the value when we look at that long-term perspective, right? As you're saying, and understanding what's that kind of trade-off in value, and does it bring the right value? But then you have to quantify how many patients may get it and what the budget looks like. And I think in some areas it kind of gets done together in a kind of negotiation or a discussion between you and the agency, let's say. You know, in the UK, NICE has methods to look at kind of the cost effectiveness, but it also employs certain rules when they look at the budget impact calculations, let's say. Whereas in other countries, they may not look at cost effectiveness as much, but they may look at more the budget impact, more as a total question and answer. So yeah, it varies. I don't think I would say, you know, within pharma, I think it's probably disingenuous just to say pharma are all just about making big money, right? I think there's certain elements there. You know, it's a lot of money to spend on bringing a molecule there needs to be a certain return. Again, this is me speaking, not from anybody else's perspective, but that would be on the perspective of, it's not even just saying we for that one product, but we want to continue developing new medicines and bringing new medicines. I think one area where there's a big struggle, right, if we look at it, for example, within pharma area and within the clinical area, is anti-infectives, right, antibiotics is a tough one, right, because the whole aim of an anti-infective, an antibiotic, is you have a really good antibiotic, but you don't want to use it, because as soon as you start using it, you drive resistance. You drive resistance, then that medicine becomes a failure. So, you know, it's great to have great science on those, but if you develop something that doesn't get used, you get no money, you can't spend more money onto research in the next best one. So you need some turnover. So that's a challenge where it's kind of, how do you ensure that you get that right return, I would say, in one respect. From the other aspect, I've definitely seen, heard, experienced where, you know, pharma have gone out of the way to make medicines available. Yeah. You know, I think in certain countries around the world where they're not as developed, let's say certain parts of Africa, there's been vaccination programs that have been run, for example.
HIV medicines, I think, would be another example.
HIV. I've not worked in HIV directly myself, but you're absolutely right. Like where they've prioritized getting it to patients that absolutely need it rather than prioritizing a pure profit or a pure return, let's say. So yeah, I think it's one of those factors.
So I can't remember if we talked about this before, but I trained in Edinburgh and I sat on something called the Scottish Medicines Consortium. And then I was a observer on NICE during my training. So NICE is kind of England and Wales. And they were very different. So the Scottish Medicines Consortium was, send in, BMS's or whoever's health economic assessment with the product and we'll look at it and take it as read, although we'll critique it. Whereas NICE, I don't know if you'll have to tell me if they still do this, but they would run in parallel their own health economic assessment. And is that still the case?
Yeah, well, yes, essentially. So you're right. I think SMC, and I'll be remiss to say that I think SMC technically came before NICE. It was definitely the first one to be set up, but maybe gets overlooked a little bit because of the size of it. It's a little bit smaller. But yeah, so my experience has been, as you're saying, SMC may be slightly smaller and they may review it and critique it, but maybe not employ as much of time and consumption in kind of running every nitty-gritty analysis possible. In NICE, they have evidence. They used to be called evidence review groups. Now they're called evidence assessment groups, I think, EAGs or ERGs. And they're kind of independent groups, quite often based within universities. So Sheffield has a EAG, Liverpool, York, Pentag, to name a few. And NICE will sort of send your submission to them and they will break it apart, essentially, look at like every aspect they possibly can to really robustly investigate and challenge what you're doing, and not challenge just for challenging sake, but they really want to understand, okay, what have we given? Is it scientifically sound? Is it robust? And what we're saying as a kind of company submitting, are we actually being honest and open and transparent and true to what we're saying? Can we back up and substantiate what we've asked for? Or are we trying to pull a fast one, let's say? And they've got, the rules and the remits, and there's a lot of guidance online where you can read about the different aspects and the guidance and the methods piece for NICE and SMCs on their own website. So I won't go through them. But, there are aspects where it's clear, black and white, and if you go outside of it, you're wrong. There's other aspects where it's tough, right? So one of the things that we quite often have to do, when I was talking about modeling earlier today, if you think about an economic model, and in oncology, again, typically we have two key elements that get considered in trials, right? The pivotal trials. You've got progression-free survival is a key outcome that typically is involved in a clinical trial, and then overall survival. An economic model wants to run and say, we want to take, it doesn't matter how many you are because it's hypothetical, but let's say in the model you say 1,000 patients. We want to run 1,000 patients all the way through the model from start to finish, so everybody dies in that model.
Yeah.
And to do that, we have to take known clinical data, the known progression-free survival Kaplan-Meier plot, the known overall survival Kaplan-Meier plot, and we have to kind of project out and estimate what that long-term survivals for each of those curves are going to look like. That helps us then build a model that tells you how what the kind of proportion of time the population will spend in each of those. Yep. We do for one arm, we do that for the one treatment, and then we do it for the other treatment. And then hopefully we would hope that the new investigation treatment, the new treatment that you're investigating would hopefully be better than the other one, and they would increase the amount of time that each patient stays in progression-free survival or overall survival or both. And then you quantify the cost and you quantify the quality adjusted life years, let's say. And how you project out the statistical methods that you run on each of those curves give you curves, and then you can select a curve. And again, you need to kind of justify and look at them and say, does this make clinical sense, right? I mean, is it clinically viable that X proportion of patients are going to be alive at 10, 15, 20 years, for example, in the survival curve, or is it lower or higher? And so some of that can be a little bit subjective, because it's like dealing with a crystal ball. We don't know, right? We don't factually know. Some of it you can base it, you're taking that known data to try and estimate out unknown data, and you can be as good as possible, but sometimes you don't quite get it right, and sometimes you get it really, really right. And so it's all about uncertainty, right? When we go in early, when a new medicine hits their trial earlier on, you normally have more uncertainty, as opposed to if you run a trial to the very end and you have all the known data, then you'd say, well, that's less uncertain. And so part of that is kind of, what's that kind of risk of uncertainty? You know, are we certain that this is going to be right, or are we uncertain that this is going to be correct? And if it's really uncertain, are we comfortable with it? And that's kind of part of those independent evidence review groups or assessment groups, to help the NICE committee see kind of that devil's advocate, I would say. That's the way I've always experienced it. When I've been sitting in front of NICE, I sit at the committee meeting and I'm putting my perspective of the known data that I have in front of me to them, and they're sitting on the other side, and they may not always agree exactly with what I'm saying. They may not be factually incorrect. They may be correct from what they say. And then the committee might say, well, who's right? And we might say, well, nobody knows who's right here. It's kind of the judgment call you need to make, and how comfortable are we all, and what's the level of uncertainty? And I think that's where it's interesting, and it's not so straightforward. And it does take a lot of, you know, of that kind of creative thinking and understanding and that brain power to work through those complex challenges.
Okay, so I've got a question for you here. So one of the truisms when you do health economic assessments for any serious disease is, if you make someone live longer, because we're not usually giving a treatment which is a cure, then it's kind of like one done. Anyone living longer is still having to have the care for their cancer in this line or some later line. And so it always costs more. You know, the cheapest patient is a dead patient, to be very flippant. And so you're really saying, look, how much am I prepared to pay for this much extension of life and good quality of life? So here's my question. Particularly in lung cancer, and particularly in some of the types that I look after, we are actually controlling people's cancer very well with minimal side effects. And some of these people are continuing to work and continuing to parent. And so are we yet at the stage where we factor in, you know, the plus side of a return? You know, they're paying taxes if they're continuing to work. Are we there yet?
I would say that very much depends in which country you're looking at. And I would also say, I don't think there's, my experience to date, I don't think there's one country which factors everything in perfectly well. I think there's still gaps of areas we can do that. It's a difficult one. I would say in some countries it's not looked at really at all. In other countries it's looked upon to some degree. They want to understand it, but they don't always make it as part of the factual decision making. And I think in others it's been utilized where they may feel that there's more of a need to, because there's more clarity that wider societal benefit is, you know, is the main benefit, for example, of the treatment beyond other aspects. I personally think there's a lot more to be done. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of different resources out there, and there's continued communications and continued push to how we can better do that. One of the groups, societies, you know, that health economists tend to be part of or work with is called ISPOR, International Society of Pharmacoeconomics. You know, there's been some publications around sort of value flowers, and how do you, again, as you're saying, quite rightly, Ross, how do we factor in some of the other wider benefits that these medicines may bring? And again, you know, as you said, oncology and in cancer, I would say typically has maybe maybe predominantly in the past. Maybe it's just my sense of it, and it may be not quite right to say this for everybody, but I think there's been a sense that maybe, oh, cancer impacts the elderly, or it's more older patients. But actually, I would say...
I mean, sometimes. It depends on...
Sometimes. But I would say even more so nowadays, you know, that we are seeing some oncology diseases affect very young patients quite early on, and as you say, very much working age. And so why shouldn't we be able to consider, if a treatment is able to bring back a patient, not just to make them feel better in their everyday generally and slow that disease, but actually get them back comfortable to work in and back in the workplace, why shouldn't that be a benefit that that medicine has been able to bring and be able to be considered in that value? So I certainly see room for improvement there, and certainly see that that could be considered, and it would be highly important to consider. My experience to date is it's not quite there, and especially it's not there consistently across the world or even across diseases. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a really important factor. And as you say, it's, you know, and that's where I think cost effectiveness should also be kind of distinguished a little bit as opposed to the pure budget impact, because a budget impact can look at it by 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, but you're taking costs of medicines, let's say some areas, big costs, whereas actually the cost effectiveness is trying to say this is a ratio. How much is the value of that medicine per quality adjusted life year that you add to that patient's life? So it's kind of breaking it down into a simpler perspective to say it's not looking as a total sum. And as you say, if you give a patient a treatment and they live longer and they continue on that treatment, then they're going to ultimately cost more, but then they're costing more because they're staying alive and the treatment is continued to be used, as opposed to stopping the treatment because of whatever the unfortunate outcome may be. All that being said, I would say there is I've seen more recently, if we think about immunotherapies, for example, there's definitely been stopping rules placed on trials where they've tried to say, okay, if you give it to a certain period of time and you stop the treatment, can they continue to receive some benefit without having to continue the treatment? So, and then we look at the other treatments like the CAR T or stem, you know, these CAR T therapies where they're kind of a single jab.
Yeah.
And hopefully that does lead to cure, and they can go very extensive periods of time. They're another challenge because the cost might look really high, but then you're giving one treatment that may be multiple years worth as opposed to monthlies, but multiple years. So there's all these factors that come into it and play to me, it's a really exciting area. And I think only to me, it's an area where it's becoming more and more increasingly important for you to have a good team that can help answer these questions, defend against these questions, plan for these questions to support access for patients around the world, right?
Given all of the companies you work for and the products you've worked with, do you have a favorite example of where HEO are as that you've contributed to?
Yeah, that's tough, you know.
I should have warned you about that question beforehand, shouldn't I?
No, it's good. I mean, I have worked on some really exciting projects. You know, careful not to name too many names. I think, you know, I was, prior to my current company, I was in another larger pharma organization, Novartis, and we were launching one of the CDK4/6 inhibitors within breast cancer. And that was, you know, we had to think very carefully about the kind of the way to model that out, because it was the first HTA in the world with a very early readout of the trial being positive. And so we had some really interesting challenges to deal with to sort of defend that long-term benefit that they came. And I think the evidence shows that the way we approached it was a really smart and appropriate way, and has proven to be correct in the long term. I think more recently, you know, I've been very focused on lung cancer in my current job at BMS, and yeah, I've done a number of really exciting work on those. Some really fascinating and interesting publications. And, you know, I think in that I've got to work on immunotherapies and targeted therapies, and they're really, you know, super exciting in those spaces, right? So having a favorite, not, I can't say one, it stands out as one favorite, but
they're all your children. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's that team that you work with at the time and the challenge that you're dealing with. You know, sometimes the answer isn't going to be what you want it to be, right? Sometimes the answer is no, we can't get it. Yes, we can't get to a situation where it ends up being great. Or as you said at the beginning, right? Like with real world evidence, sometimes the data doesn't look as promising or as good as we'd hoped it to be. And you sometimes say, well, but what have we learned from it? So it's also the learning side of things, which I really find interesting. It's kind of like, you can't always be perfect. You can't always get it right. And sometimes they're going to be, it starts off looking great and ends up ultimately not being as positive. That happens.
All right. Before we get to your future plans, I got a flippant question here. So one of the things I know about you is that you don't have a car. And I just wondered whether you did some kind of economic analysis of not having a car versus the cost of Ubers and trains.
That's a really good question. I've never applied that, actually. I probably always, you know, I'm a big football fan over in England.
You're an Arsenal fan, right?
Yeah, an Arsenal Football Club fan. So, and I have a season ticket. And for the American listeners, the soccer is, you know, the kind of the relevant sport. So, I've probably been more interested in looking at what the cost effectiveness is of signing a new player versus not signing, for example. But no, I haven't at the moment. I have it's a complicated situation, and partly down to, I don't want to say laziness, but partly down to me prioritizing different aspects. So I have a license. I have a license from the US, and I've driven for many years comfortably there. And I lived in Italy in Milan for a year, and I drove over there.
That's terrifying there.
It can be, yeah, it can be, especially when you're English and you're only there for a year and you're not an expert on every aspect. But to do it in England, you have to do the theory and the actual practical test. And they're quite difficult to book tests, and they're quite a lot of, it's a bit of money. And I'm completely comfortable with my driving abilities. But I just, when I came back and when I was in university, I was living quite central London where it was a lot of trains. And so I've been in and around London now since 2006, I think. So I would say, what's that? That's 19 years almost. And in all of those times, I've always lived pretty connected to a kind of underground or an overground train station. When I went back after the COVID and I moved back down and I bought my house, I'm in a kind of villagey part on the outskirts of London. There is a train and there is an underground. It's on the opposite end of my village. So it's a sort of 10, 15 minute walk down to it. So I'm quite often lazy in the mornings and I get an Uber or a kind of Bolt, let's say, into the office. Two times a week has not tended to be too expensive, I have to say. But that being said, I am on the journey now to get a car sorted. So I probably will end up getting a car.
Oh my goodness.
Shopping is going to be a lot easier with that. So yeah, I definitely need a car. When I come back to Cambridge with my dog, it would be a lot easier than getting the trains. And it's definitely getting more and more expensive on the public transport. So yeah, a car will probably end up being equally cheap or equally, you know, the same cost. So yeah.
That's cool. Well, let's turn to you. I mean, you've been tremendously successful just moving up, covering, you know, like starting with one country and then, you know, eventually now covering global. What's the future going to hold for you?
That's a good question. Who knows? I mean, what I can be sure about is, yeah, I was BMS for 5 years. There's been some ongoing changes in the organization, and I think it's no surprise to those that are kind of within the medical world or know pharma generally, that happens fairly frequently. Let's say there's organizational changes. So recently I was impacted, and that means I'm going to be moving on from that company. I'll be leaving them in my current role. The next role is TBC at this moment in time. But what I can say is I'm definitely going over to Japan actually in a few weeks' time, and I'm going to have a nice holiday in Japan for about just over 2 weeks, and I've never been to Japan in my life. So this is a really exciting opportunity to kind of maximize a little bit of a break, a little bit of rest time for my brain before I start the next role and the next part of my journey. But yeah, hopefully it maintains within the kind of global health economic sphere. I don't want to walk away from health economics, so I'm consistent in staying there. And oncology really, I think, stands out. It's an exciting area. Is that, I don't know, perverse to say? I used to say breast is best when I used to work on breast cancer.
Yeah.
A little bit of a tease, but you know, I really enjoyed working in that disease. I've really enjoyed working on lung cancer, so I don't want to walk away from that if I can help it. So I'm really looking, hopefully, for a kind of role to stay within primarily oncology, but hopefully within lung cancer as well, to some degree, and within health economics at a global level.
Well, I hope our paths cross again. Adam, thank you for sharing your journey and your expertise with us. Thank you.
A pleasure, Ross. It's been, you know, really exciting to be part of this. Health economics to me is a really fascinating area. I think it lends itself to a wide application across pharma, consultancy, and even in the clinical sphere. There's a lot that can be done with it. I'm hugely passionate about it. And I think it's only becoming more and more important. We see some of the political changes. We see some of the current questions that are going on in the external environment. So I'm confident that it's only going to become more of an important area that we can leverage to kind of support. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.